This is the sixth day of this July 2011 seven-day session. And we will take up a koan this morning. This is from the Mumon Kan, or the Gateless Barrier, number 31, Joshu Sees Through the Old Woman. And here's the case. We'll get to the commentary and verse later. A monk asked an old woman, "What is the way to Mount Gotai?" The old woman said, "Go straight on." After the monk had taken a few steps, she said, "A good, respectable monk, but he too goes off like that." Later, a monk told Joshu about this, and Joshu said, "Wait a bit. I'll go and investigate that old woman for you." The next day, off he went and asked her the same question and got the same reply. On returning, Joshua announced to his assembly of monks, "I have investigated and seen through the old woman of Mount Gotai for you." I'm not going to read any of the many dialogues involving Joshu. Let's use his real Chinese name, Zhao Zhou. His dates are 778 to 897, which places him squarely in the great Tang Dynasty. He's reported to have lived to the age of 120. Somewhere I read that when he was asked to what he attributed his long life, how old he was when he died, he said, systematic fasting when he had been younger. We know now from medical research, at least with rats, that that under-eating is correlated with longer life. Bummer, I know. So I'm reading here from the Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion. It'll just give a rather brief overview of Zhao Zhou for those who may not have heard it. His teacher was the great Nanxuan or Nansen. Zhao Zhou came to be known as the Old Buddha out of respect. It says here that Zhao Zhou had 13 Dharma successors, but since there were few who equaled him, let alone surpassed him, in profundity of experience, his lineage died out after a few generations. I think this is a specious linkage to suggest a causal connection between his line dying out and few people, few of his successors equaling him. The great Yunmen or Ummon. Also, his lineage didn't last that long, relatively speaking. But it's not necessarily because his Dharma successors didn't have. It's not because Yunmen lacked anything in terms of insight. There are many things that can go into it, into the length, the longevity of a lineage, which we don't need to get into now. says the life story of Zhao Zhou is an especially good example of what Zen masters repeatedly stress, that enlightenment is only the beginning of real training on the path of Zen. Zhao Zhou reached his first Kensho at the age of 18, and after that he trained for another 40 years under Nanxuan. And when Zhao Zhou, we're told that full enlightenment at the age of 56, after his first Kensho at 18. After Nanxuan died, Zhao Zhou set about wandering in order to deepen his experience further through Dharma combat with other Chan masters. It is said that during this period, he sought out as many as 80 of the Dharma successors of the great Ma Zu, Baso. Ma Zu was said to have had 139 enlightened disciples. So Zhao Zhou still had more that he didn't get to. And finally, when he was 80, it was only when he was 80 that he began teaching. He settled in a small monastery in the town of Zhao Zhou, where he took his name. It was typical, very common for the masters to become known by the name of the town or the mountain where they settled. And there at Zhao Zhou, finally many students gathered around him. And then he died at 120. There's an extract here. I don't know where from, but I'll just read it. Zhao Zhou had a way of instructing his students that people called Zhao Zhou's lip and mouth chan. In a soft voice, often almost whispering, he answered his students' questions with short, simple pronouncements. His words, though, were very powerful. It is said that they were able to cut through the deluded feeling and thinking of his students like a sharp sword. And this one last thing, Zhao Zhou appears in 19 koans. Six of them in the Mumonkan, and the others in the Blue Cliff Record. Now let's get back to the case. A monk asked an old woman, "What is the way to Mount Gotai?" This too, this Gotai is the Japanized version of the name of the mountain, which is Wutai. So let's use that now, from now on. What is the way to Wutai Shan, Mount Wutai? Wutai Shan came to be known as the abode of Manjusri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. There are all kinds of legends about Manjusri, sightings of Manjusri on Wutai Shan. Wutai Shan literally means a five terrace mountain, because it's not just a simple singular mountain like a child would draw, but it's even though it says five terrace mountain, it's really a much bigger area. Oh yeah, we went there when I was on my second pilgrimage to China. with two companions. The three of us went to Wu Tai Shan, and the other three of the two of the other four so-called holy mountains of China. And I was surprised to see how big and sprawling it was. The so-called five terraces are more like five peaks spread out quite a bit. The area is it's big. There's a lot of land. When we were there, we learned that during the time of Zhao Zhou and the Tang Dynasty, there were 800 temples in this Wu Tai Shan. Some clustered closer together, others spread further apart. It was quite a poignant experience being there, because this was now 26 years ago, and there was almost nothing going on there. There were a lot of ruins of what we heard were the original 800 temples. It was sort of like a ghost town. Not in a town, on a mountain. What we learned was that there had been 800 temples during the Tang Dynasty, and then that had, during the Cultural Revolution, that was reduced to... The Cultural Revolution is when these marauding Red Guard troops, most of them very young guys, destroyed many of the temples, and can't remember how many they reduced them to, but when I was there, they said that there were only 49 temples left, and I wouldn't call them temples. There were a few that you could call temples, but what we saw was mostly just ruins, run-down buildings, and a lot of grass, tall grass. I have this vivid memory of standing there, and it was a windy day, and this the wind blowing the grass around a certain temple, and just it was a good dose of a reminder of impermanence. I've heard reports that the government has been building it up. Even there, even when I was there, there was a little bit of rebuilding going on. I remember seeing the going up to one of the temples, and there were donkeys carrying timber up, led by just craftsmen, builders. The government realized early on that there was gold in them there hills. If they could attract foreigners who had interest in Buddhism, and they set about to rebuild some of these temples so they could draw more tourists there, and they could get American dollars and German marks and so forth. We ran into one monk, young monk. Luckily, I was with the two people I was with could speak some Chinese decently well, and when we had a short exchange with the monk, he took aside Peter Bogdanov. And his wife, they had been living in China studying acupuncture, and they studying Chinese. And the monk confided to them that he had not lived anywhere near there. He had lived in another part of China, and the government had kind of scooped up in different parts of China. They'd scooped up this monk and that monk and brought them there, so it looked more convincing as a temple, as a working, a real temple. He had to take them out of the eyesight and earshot of the government minders who were lurking around looking for and managing, trying to manage impressions there. But the whole thing left us with a feeling of, I have to say, a little gloom to see how everything had gone down there. At the same time, we had the imagination to realize that what a place this must have been at one time. 800 temples. It would draw thousands, tens of thousands of monks and others there, great masters, including Zhao Zhou. And part of the reason that all those temples sprang up in the first place was this legend about it being the abode of Manjusri, the great Manjusri himself, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. We have a figure of Manjusri right here on the altar set. We set it before the Buddha figure during Sesshin to emphasize the importance, the emphasis in at Sesshin of the wisdom of realizing our true nature, coming to this experiential wisdom. Manjusri is typically shown either wielding a sword, the delusion-cutting sword of Manjusri, or sitting astride a lion, the lion representing the courage and the vigor and the vitality and energy that is released through awakening. Down the hall on the way to Doksan, I almost said on the way to Wutaishan, on the way to Doksan, there is a painting of Manjusri there too. He's shown on this fierce, massive lion. We can call Manjusri the sort of the archetype of wisdom. We could also call him the embodiment of fundamental wisdom. And what is that? What is the core realization in Zen? It is seeing the emptiness of this world of phenomena. The world of form. We chant it in the Prajnaparamita. Form here is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness no other than form. We can't tease them apart, what we call form and emptiness. We could say that emptiness is that aspect of this world of appearances. That's the world of form, phenomena. It's that aspect that is not. It's the negative side of this world of negative, not negative in the sense of that which gives the appearance but is not truly there. This is impossible for anyone to really understand who hasn't had some insight into their true nature, into the emptiness of form. You can talk about it, people can get kind of a conceptual idea of it, but of course there's no It's not like having the direct experience of it, which we call kensho, or enlightenment. Maybe a way to describe it that make it a little more meaningful or accessible is as an aspect of impermanence. We know even through modern science that this world of things is actually a world of energy in different forms, but energy that of different kinds of densities. The density of iron is one form of energy, and the density of water is another, and even air. And if everything is energy, then everything is in flux. Now, right now, it seems so real, doesn't it? How could that be in flux? Seems pretty solid. This is maybe a little more believable that it's in flux. We know from medicine that we're something like 70-something percent water. Okay, we can get more of a sense of the mutability of the human body, living things in general. But it's all a matter of degree. In truth, what gives the appearance of matter, of form, is actually formless. I read a statement by a physicist who said that this is really the way to understand Einstein's theory of relativity, is when he talks about mass equals mc squared. Really, mass, the physicist said, really means what gives the appearance of mass. So physics seems to finally have caught up with what the Buddha realized under the Bodhi tree 2,500 years ago. Now, of course, this is a radical, radical, outrageous way to understand what we think of as reality, that it's empty. It's fundamentally, there is no fixed substance. That as soon as we say this ton is, there, it is. How could you say it's not? It is. Oh no, not so fast. Because as soon as we say that, it's already has shifted. It's already changed. So it's a world of illusion, really. It's a great consensus about this illusion that things are real and solid and have real substance to them and are relatively unchanging. Some things are seem to be never changing, and others well more quickly. But this is how human beings have come to interpret the evidence of our senses. But we are deceived by our senses. Our senses are not like the kind of instruments that are used now in physics and medicine. We don't have the ability to see the way in which this world before our eyes is all shimmering, the way in which it's unreal, evanescent. Our senses are pretty darn good. We cover a lot of breadth in terms of seeing pretty tiny things. An electron microscope can't see the distances that we can with our eyes, and and telescopes can't see the fine details we can see. It's pretty effective, these senses that we have in terms of getting along in our lives, managing circumstances and conditions, but they don't reveal the underlying nature of things, which is empty. And if the world of physical phenomena of trees and fans and wax candles and people, women and men, if physical things are fundamentally empty, how much more so our thoughts, our emotions, our feelings. So this is the realm, this realm of emptiness, of no thingness, is the realm of Manjushri. And according to the legend, his seat is on Mount Wutai. So, with that as a background, a monk asks an old woman, what is the way to to Wutai Shan? On this pilgrimage that I took, leading up to each of these holy mountains, there would be a lot of vendors sitting with their little things. I didn't know half of what they were selling, herbs would be a real common one. Herbs to heal you, and tea, and I can't even remember all the things, but just these weren't, they were just little tables with little knickknacks or stuff on them, these vendors would hope to interest the tourists. Even when I was there, there were quite a few Chinese tourists. There were virtually no Western tourists, but they were Chinese tourists by the busload. And we learned from someone there that it's not that they were there for the Dharma. they were there out of national pride. They had been told in their communes. These communes could be hundreds of people. They were told about the great cultural heritage of Buddhism, and although many of them seemed to have no interest at all in Buddhism, they'd get together, be like an outing, like a company outing, and they would go and chattering wildly, having no feeling at all, no respect for any of these temples or. And the vendors would then hope to they would stop and buy some of their herbs or whatever, and maybe this old woman was one of those vendors, or who knows. But anyway, she's an old woman, and she has not just this one monk as suggested by the case, but various monks on their way. Stop, maybe wipe their brow, and ask, what is the way to Wutai Shan? And her response, go straight on. Now, it's not giving away that much of the koan to suggest that what the koan is asking us to is really, what is the way to wisdom? What is the way to enlightenment? Koans are metaphors, and that's one that would be easy enough for any student to understand. And what's this response? The old woman said, go straight on. One way to understand straight on is with an undivided mind. This is our work in Sesshin, isn't it? The undivided mind, unfragmented, but a unified mind, which is a powerful mind. After the monk had taken a few steps, she said, "A good, respectable monk, but he too goes off like that." Pretty provocative. Did she just sort of mutter this to herself after he'd gone around the corner? Or did she say it for him to hear? When I was there, or when I was on the way to Wutaishan, I came to appreciate this response of the old woman in a whole different way. When she says, "Go straight on," because it was a long, long trip. I don't remember where we started. The Wutaishan is in the northern half of China. But it took a long train trip, 12 hours or something from Beijing maybe. And then after we deboarded the train, then the last leg of the trip to this Wutaishan was on a bus. And this is what we discovered. It was a six-hour bus ride, and I have never been on such a winding road. 6 hours of curves. Go straight on. And it was the original road that we took the bus on. It was lined and there were sections of it where mile after mile there would be hemp fields on one or both sides of the road. Gigantic, looked like marijuana. I guess some variety of hemp, but it looked like marijuana. 8 foot, 10 foot high plants. So then this monk, or we can suppose any of the monks who had gotten this treatment at the hand of this woman, when they got to Zhaozhou's temple up there in Wutaishan, they told him about it. Or at least, let's say, word got to him. And he said, "Hang on, I'll go and investigate that old woman for you." Now, why would Zhaozhou, who undoubtedly had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of monks in his temple for whom he is responsible, why would he go down the mountain to check out this old woman? It's one of the points of the koan. So the next day, off he went, and he asked her the same question that the monks had asked. What's the way to Wutaishan? And he got the same reply. Go straight on. And he got the same follow-up. A good, respectable monk, but he too goes off like that. What about this old woman? This is really one of the main points of the koan. What's up with this old woman? Does she have insight? Is she an imposter? Just a kind of audacious old woman who likes to sport with these monks and with Joshu, Zhaozhou. It's no doubt what the monks themselves were wondering. It may have generated quite a buzz in the monastery. Well, Zhaozhou had his exchange with the old woman. All the koan is very vague. Just, this is the nature of koans. They just give us, in broad strokes, what happened in the dialogue or in the story. And all we're told is that he goes back up, he gathers the monks, and he says, "I have investigated and seen through the old woman of Wu Taishan for you." "Oh, thanks a lot, Zhaozhou. Appreciate it." So what did he see in this old woman? What did he see? Then we have Mumon's commentary that he added. "The old woman knew how to sit still and plot strategy, yet she is not aware of the bandits stealing into the tent. Old Zhaozhou is clever enough to creep into the enemy's camp and menace a fortress, but he wasn't a great commander. Upon close examination, they both have their faults. Tell me now, what was Zhaozhou's insight into the old woman?" That's really the nub of the koan, that last question. This wonderful language here of Mumon's, this vivid drawing from military vocabulary. She knew how to sit still and plot strategy. Could she have set up Zhaozhou by sending these monks back to him to lure him down from the mountain? Wait, not so fast. She's not aware of the bandits stealing into the tent. And what is this where Mumon says Zhaozhou wasn't, but he wasn't a great commander? What sense? What does he mean? That's another point of the koan. And then to say, upon close examination, they both have their faults. Well, maybe we can come up with some idea of the woman's fault, but what would be Zhaozhou's fault? And now the verse. "The question is the same each time. The answer, too, is the same. Sand in the rice, thorns in the mud." The question is the same each time. It may take many forms, this question, but essentially, it's the same. The answer, too, is the same. Sand in the rice, thorns in the mud. When you're eating rice, you don't expect to encounter sand. When you're walking through mud, you don't expect to step on a thorn. Appearances can be deceiving. Going back to this matter of form and emptiness, which is actually the matter of all this work, I love what the passage from the Lankavatara Sutra. The Lankavatara Sutra is one of the most esteemed in the Zen school. There are many sutras, but there are several that are you hear most in the Zen school. The Lankavatara Sutra was supposed to have been Bodhidharma's favorite sutra. But there's this line in there. Things are not what they appear to be, nor are they otherwise. That is the breathtaking profundity of the Dharma. They're not what they appear to be. Mm-mm. Neither are they otherwise. Not this, not that. Where does that leave us? Which is it? Moo. You can hear the monks gathering when Zhaozhou comes back up to the mountain, all excited to finally get the answer. You can almost hear them asking, okay, Master, which is it? In effect, he's telling her, you're going to have to see through this old woman yourself. Don't expect me to answer your questions. The seeing has to be on your part. I could give you this answer or that answer. I could describe her. But what does that matter? You need to see for yourself. Our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.